Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 3 of Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history. My name's Hugh Lemmy. I'm a writer, author, artist.
And I'm Ben Miller, a writer and researcher and member of the board of the Schwules Museum in Berlin.
Last week we were talking about the lovers, the playwrights, authors, artists, Joe Orton and Kenneth Halliwell. Who are we talking about this week, Ben?
Well, today's subject was an initially uneducated woman who was born in about 1880, and in her nearly 70 years of life, this woman rose from enslavement to being a sex worker to being a female king. Both a leader of her community of Enugu Ezike in present-day Nigeria and a collaborator with British colonialism in the region, she, like other kings, had multiple wives. Finally removed from power by British officials and local elders because she participated in a ritual in a way that only men were supposed to, the complex life of Ahebi Ugbabe helps tell the story of the colonization of Nigeria and of the similarities and differences between the sex gender systems we're used to in the contemporary West, possibilities in those sex gender systems throughout different human societies and human history.
Well, this sounds like it's going to be a really interesting story.
So we know as much as we do about the life of this extraordinary person thanks to the historical work of Nwando Achebe. And if that last name, Achebe, sounds familiar, it's because she's the daughter of Chinua Achebe, who is the world-famous Nigerian writer. His first novel, Things Fall Apart, is one of the most widely read and assigned African novels. Achebe was also an influential critic of Orientalism and racism in Western writing about Africa.
Right, he writes an amazing essay about Conrad.
About Conrad and Heart of Darkness. And in that work, he describes Conrad and Heart of Darkness as perpetuating a racist understanding of Africa as other and of Africans as people without humanity, of Africa as a place where Europe can work out its view of itself. And this is an essay that's extremely influential in post-colonial discourse. And one of the things that he argues in that essay is that despite Conrad's intent to describe the horrors of colonization, the work still perpetuated stereotypes of and images about Africa and Africans that had the power to enact violence. And whether those were intentionally inserted or not, the text, through unconscious bias, was able to hurt in the present. Right? Uh-huh. It wasn't important whether that was an intentional insertion or not. Now, that is a sobering analysis for a white Western podcaster about to dive into a conversation about African history. Throughout this episode, I am going to name my perspective, describe my limitations, and be very clear about what the source of this episode is. The archives of primary sources about Ahebe's life are not in languages that I speak, and actually most of them are living archives. Most of what we know about Ahebe comes from oral history work. Mm-hmm. And that oral history work comes out of Nwando Achebe's book, The Female King of Colonial Nigeria, which was published by Indiana University Press in 2011. Nwando Achebe is professor of history at Michigan State University, and she specializes in oral history and gender and sexuality in West Africa. This book won several prizes. It was widely praised by historians, and it led to this sort of cottage industry of third-party articles about Achebe, and I guess ours is now joining that.
Okay.
And so in the text, she begins by reflecting on her own perspective. She refers to the book as, quote, a narrative constructed through the prism of performance, of constant movement and negotiation between the researcher, the research, and the audience, reminding us that a spectator and a dance, in this case, the researcher in the quote-unquote spectator audience, cannot appreciate the performance of the dance by standing in one position, end quote. She's constantly reflecting in the text about her own relationship to the sources in the text. And so her research methods for the book are oral history. She interviewed collaborators, as she refers to the people she interviews rather than subjects, in the community of Enugu Ezike, where Ahebe had lived. And the first time she started asking about her, she said people were not particularly forthcoming. Quote, the community had a secret that they were not about to let me in on, at least not during this particular research trip. They would make me wait 2 more years, as though insisting that I had the right to know, end quote. So she basically says that crucial details of the story were only revealed to her by community leaders and elders that she was collaborating with after several years of work in the village, and after it became clear that she was a trustworthy interlocutor. He describes having a breakthrough with one collaborator, which then led to other people being willing to share information that could corroborate things rather than being the first people to tell her some new thing.
Yeah.
And she writes that this made her, quote, a daughter of the community, no longer a guest, right? Someone who could be trusted with all this information. And so the process of the book began with taking these oral histories from indigenous narrators and then fleshing out the story with written research, archival research, map work. And the book is the culmination of 15 years of research in Igbo land and Igala land in contemporary Nigeria. And so we can only be grateful to Nwando Achebe and these collaborators for sharing this story with us. And throughout the episode, I'm going to pause every once in a while to kind of add a new layer to the constructed narrative by reflecting on the distances between us and our audience and the text and its audience. And hopefully we can kind of invite all of these different positions into this dam. As part of this, we should begin by reflecting on the long history of white Western queers looking to non-white others and their societies as sources of information about a supposedly universal past, one that living non-white societies were assumed to represent, where queers had run free. This tendency, the colonial cousin, or maybe the colonial dibbuk haunting the history and present of queer liberation, has been the subject of much of my own academic research.
And we've covered in plenty of podcasts, I think, Lawrence of Arabia and the Stonewall Colony and things like that.
Of course. Lawrence of Arabia, the Stonewall Colony, the Chinese Emperor Dongshan in the kind of meta conversation about the historical work on him. And maybe most of all, I think, in the chapter in our book about Margaret Mead.
Right.
We've talked about places where educated Westerners have been far too easy to scan non-white peoples for things that seem to justify our own sexual choices and preferences, and then to present this as a kind of naturalizing evidence of the universal nature of queer life. Achebe criticizes this tendency so soon in her introduction that I want to note this critique, even as we are, in some meta sense, fitting the conversation we're having under the broad rubric of bad gays. She talks about an earlier article that she'd written about Ahebe, where she'd mentioned Ahebe's story and a critic who had accused her of, quote, deliberately skewing evidence against a supposed lesbian sexual preference, end quote. And her reply is, quote, I in no way ascribe to the fiction of a purely heterosexual Africa. Homosexuality exists in all societies. However, woman-to-woman marriage in Africa has absolutely nothing to do with homosexuality. It instead speaks to the performance of social and economic status and class, as well as to the performance of a female masculinity, a woman's prerogative to assume the gendered position of husband within a culturally sanctioned relationship, end quote. So Achebe also spends a lot of time in the introduction talking about the ethical imperative of telling one's own story as an Igbo historian and a Nigerian historian. And for this reason, I want to make it clear that I'm not suggesting in any way that Ahebe was somehow a lesbian. But I do think that taking the lead from Achebe's use of queer theory to ground her concept of female masculinity, we can think about gay in this episode in that kind of grand old Foucauldian way, something that helps us reveal the slantwise or the constructed nature of all sex gender systems. I think there is something bad and something gay about this story, even if the answer is certainly not insisting that its protagonist, a person living in the extremely different sex gender system of late 19th and early 20th century colonial Nigeria, fits into a contemporary Western identity category, neatly or otherwise. Later in the book, she writes, quote, in pre-colonial Igbo land, sex and gender did not coincide, and therefore biological women could be characterized as social males. Now, this also, at least to the ears of a white queer historian versed in the 12 or so years of trans discourse and theory that have developed after this text was published, seems to point to the distinct possibility of a transmasculine way of thinking about this story. But again, we should be cautious not to replicate in the realm of trans history what has so often occurred in the realm of gay and lesbian history. White historians in the global north using the lives and bodies of people in the global south as raw materials with which to create narratives about our eternal presence in the world. So I want to remain open to the possibility of reading this story in a way that resonates with the themes of this podcast without making any claims about exactly what this person should be understood to represent.
Right.
And I actually don't think that this is so totally different from what we do when we describe a Roman emperor under the rubric of bad gay. right? We do this knowingly with the knowledge that they lived in an extremely different sex gender system than the one that produced the homosexuality that we understand ourselves as inhabiting today.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal here is to take the same approach with this story, to read it for what we can learn about the specific sex gender system in which this person lived, and the variety of sex gender systems in pre-colonial non-Western societies, without reading a specific contemporary meaning onto the past. One of the central arguments that Achebe makes is that Ahebe's, quote, gendered performance was premised on the reality that in pre-colonial Igbo land, gender and sex did not coincide. Instead, gender was flexible and fluid, allowing women to become men and men to become women. This created unique Igbo female masculinities, such as female husbands and female sons and male priestesses. To be sure, Ahebe's transformation into a female king was unprecedented, but what was even more incredible was the fact that Ahebe was able to achieve this feat in a society in which kings had no place. The institution was viewed almost as an affront to the Igbo belief in egalitarianism, end quote. Dancing with Achebe here a bit, I'll say that I think it's really instructive to think about a society in which the existence of a king is more surprising than the fact that a socially male king might be female.
Yeah.
And I say socially and biologically here not to construct artificial and transphobic distinctions, but instead to discuss a sex gender system in which sex and gender seem to have been truly radically separate from one another. From the perspective of a contemporary queer person trying to understand how our sex gender system has been constructed and might evolve, perceiving the fact that it is not an inevitability that sex and gender travel with one another, and in fact that many times and in many places it has not been entirely simple to determine what a man is and what a woman is, that man and woman as we understand them are social categories which put together a bunch of different social and biological characteristics in these sort of rough constellations that need not be constructed in precisely that way is, I think, very important. Ahebe Ugbabe was born around 1880. Her surname Ugbabe means giant vulture, the kind that attacks carcasses. She had two brothers, Onoja and Onobeta. The town of Enugu Ezike was hilly. A 1911 British colonial census recorded about 11,500 residents, and a 1931 census about 28,000. The people made their living through the palm tree. They tapped it for palm wine, and they traded other palm products like palm oil via middlemen to Europe. Cloth making was also a center of industry, but most farming was subsistence farming. The soil was sandy and not suitable for mass crop production. As a child, Ahebe spent a lot of time in her mother's village, Unadu. One of the oral history collaborators remembers her as having been, quote, created great by God from early childhood, end quote. Now, at this time, local marriage customs indicated that suitors would come to visit when a young girl was approximately 13 and 14 years old, with the marriage to then be consummated after the bride had begun to menstruate. And she seems to have rejected several of these suitors until one of them, Ezenwa Ezema, requested permission to travel with her to another town, where at some point he raped her. And then, according to many of the different collaborators, she, quote, got lost, end quote. And Achebe argues that that term, got lost, is a way of both communicating and concealing the truth of what had happened to her. And that truth, as Achebe reconstructs it, is that her family was experiencing economic crisis and bad fortune. A local diviner, someone who was thought to be able to read the future, who's someone who mediated between the world of humans and the world of spirits, decided that she needed to be married off to the goddess Ohe, who was the goddess of creation and fertility. The goddess said that this diviner was punishing her father for a crime he had committed against a relative, and the solution was to marry the girl off to the goddess. Now, Ohe and the sort of social structures that encompassed human deity marriages were part of a response by communities in this region to the effects of the slave trade, devastating effects on local social structures. Achebe writes that these spiritual forces, quote, helped them fight the slave trade and the people who were left behind. These deities were primarily female and worked to protect and repopulate the societies that owned them, end quote. The women were married to female deities in order to repopulate society. The women who married them were not allowed to marry free men, but they could have sex with men who were understood as sperm donors for the goddess who was then repopulating the community. The women who married the goddess were supposed to welcome their fate. It was considered part of that relationship to give yourself freely, even as a living sacrifice. But Ahebe, who one of the collaborators recalls was a, quote, difficult and conceited girl who did not listen to reason, end quote, refused. And instead of agreeing to live under those conditions, she fled her community. Ahebe was ethnically Igbo, and Enugu Ezike was a primarily Igbo community. The Igbo are one of the three largest of the many ethnic groups who make up contemporary Nigeria, alongside the Hausa and the Yoruba. And she fled to Igalaland, which was before British colonization an independent kingdom of the Igala people somewhat northwest of Enugu Ezike. And there she would spend the next 20 or so years. Our governing systems in Igalaland were quite different than governing systems in Igboland. In Igalaland, the power was more concentrated in kings, as opposed to Igbo systems of governance, which were based on power sharing and gerontocracy. But Igalaland had a historical female king, Ata Ebulejonu, who reigned in the 16th century. Now, when we say female king here, we mean precisely that, right? Queen would have a different connotation, just like husband and wife had different gendered connotations. A female king in this story is a female person who inhabited the gendered social and political role of king. And I think this, if you're familiar with Western sex gender systems, can be a contradictory idea. But it's one that I think is worth sitting with, because appreciating what it means is key, I think, to what we can learn from this story. She went to Igalaland, Achebe suggests, because she likely begun her journey of flight by going about 7 kilometers to her mother's village, which was the first village into Igalaland from Enugu Ezike. Traveling in early colonial Nigeria involved a mix of paved roads, footpaths, and travel by waterways. The furthest distance she traveled during her exile from home would have been several days' journey. Now, in exile, she was supporting herself as a sex worker, partially because she was not traveling alone. When she was raped by Ezenwa Ezema, she became pregnant with a daughter, Orefi Eze. Sex work could be extremely profitable in this place and time. It was one British official who characterized women working in the sex trade as, quote, itinerant gold mines, unquote. Differently from women in colonial cities who often worked in brothels, women in rural areas worked from their own homes, and they seemed to have had more control over their labor and higher incomes. This period in Igalaland was characterized by the arrival of British colonizers. From 1851 until approximately the turn of the 20th century, the British gradually invaded and colonized what is today known as Nigeria. This brutal invasion and subjugation was disguised in the quote-unquote moral obligation of the desire to end human sacrifice and integrate Nigeria into free trade. Repeated raids and the establishment of trading stations after the raids characterized a gradual integration of this territory and its people into the British Empire. The British decision to abolish the slave trade meant that further raids and incursions could be justified through the desire to abolish the domestic slave trade. Here's a country that had at least partially made itself rich by trading in African bodies, now presuming to further invade and subjugate the continent in order to halt the slave trade. And right. That's how quickly the justifications for colonization can rewrite themselves. Sex workers in Igboland, where Enugu Ezike was, were constructed as quote-unquote free women. They were independent, sometimes they were admired, they were able to form friendships with men, their labor was not governed by pimps or madams. These women were, Achebe says, quote, not engaged in the servicing of men, but in an assertion of their fundamental right to do whatever they desired with their own body, end quote. But when these sex workers migrated out, they often faced quite different social relations. So in Igalaland, where she was in flight, sex work had more social opprobrium. Unlike Igbo women, Igala women were expected to be chaste until marriage. And Achebe does a linguistic analysis and reveals that the words that were used to describe sex workers were much more derogatory and often implied ownership by men.
Hmm.
And this work was often combined with trading, farming, and other kinds of service work. And Ahebe was no exception. She started working as a trader, which was a very common profession and was enabled by Igalaland's location at the place where three rivers, the Niger, the Benue, and the Anambra, come together. So she traded potash, which is a potassium salt used as a fertilizer that you get by soaking wooden ashes in water in a pot,
mm-hmm.
and palm oil and kola nut, and eventually horses. and she became one of the richest horse traders in Igala Land, and through her sex work gained connections with many prominent men, including the king of Igala Land, Atta Igala. And she dabbled in both good and occult spiritual practices and medicine, partially to protect her from the anger of the goddess that she had refused to marry but was supposed to. But in addition to allying herself with the spirits, Ahebe also allied herself with the British. Between 1909 and 1920, the British ran a series of raids into Enugu Ezike, which they characterized as being an attempt to address the slave trade in the area. But to run these patrols, they needed local informants. And Ahebe seems to have strategically allied herself with the British using knowledge that she gained about the paths between the regions during her period of flight. They accompanied the British into two of the towns they raided, and this may have been a calculated alliance. In other words, she may have actually accompanied British colonizers and helped bring them to her hometown in order to colonize her people. And there's reasons why she might have done this. It could have been due to her opposition to the slave trade and to things like human goddess marriages, which the British called domestic slavery, based on her own life story. And it could also be interpreted as kind of a rejection of her own people based on what they had tried to do to her earlier in life. She was given a British helmet, which she ended up wearing as a crown. Despite the assistance of Ahebe and other locals, the British invasion of Igboland was not easy. There was a lot of fighting, there was a lot of destruction, there was a lot of local resistance. And in that 11-year period that it took them to develop firm control of this part of Nigeria, British demands that subjugated Igbo people bring out all of their weapons to be destroyed in public by British troops led to a lot of anger and resistance. British rule in colonial Nigeria was performed, as elsewhere in the British Empire, indirectly. Right, local political elites were chosen to manage British rule. In Igboland, local political elites were chosen to be so-called warrant chiefs. These were people who would impose British control through existing local institutions, and they kind of mediated between British law and local law and custom. So the British got from this the ability to administer vast amounts of territory inexpensively and without having to construct political and social institutions from the ground up. But what this often did was had a really disfiguring effect on local societies, because people could very rapidly become political elites with no kind of legitimacy or justification in the local community just because of their alliance with the British. So Ahebe, who had possibly aided the British in their invasion of Enugu Ezike, and who spoke the languages of the Igala border region, and she also spoke Igbo, and she also spoke some English, made herself an indispensable ally of these colonists. So she became first a female headman, and then a female warrant chief. One of Achebe's collaborators says, quote, "When Ahebe returned newly, it was not joyfully accepted that their lost child had returned. She was dreaded, but the people were afraid to say anything, because the British administration had already come," end quote.
Wow.
And this new order offered Ahebe and other ambitious people new possibilities for power. Within a few months, she had replaced an aged local who didn't speak any English as the British government's recognized headman of her village. British colonizers did not recognize Igbo political and spiritual governance systems where male and female elders shared political power. Instead, they often appointed younger men who ended up accumulating much more individual power than had ever been accumulated in Igbo communities until this point. The colonial Enugu Ezike was divided into 33 villages, and each one had its own headman. Headmen administered local justice, they laid down the law, and warrant chiefs also sat as members of these native courts that the British set up. And so they were, as you can imagine, often quite unpopular, right? This created a new kind of class society where ambitious young men who were not afraid of being disliked could gain power quickly through the administration of colonial justice. Ahebe was named headman in what seems to have been a quite singular moment of a female performance of this new male class role. But by 1918, she had been named a warrant chief, one of three principal members in the area's native court. The position was often given to a headman who had some kind of book knowledge. And Achebe describes Ahebe's inhabiting this role as a kind of female masculinity. And women having political power had not been unusual in pre-colonial Igbo land, but she may have been the only female headman in all of British Africa.
Wow.
And colonial sources at the time identified her as, quote, a lady of influence and power, loyal and controls her quarter well, although owing to her loyalty to the British, her people assaulted her and drove her out of town during the patrol. She is intelligent and of a quiet disposition. When she does speak, it is usually to the point and is sensible, end quote. Now, these positive reports in British intelligence contrast with their often extremely negative reports about other warrant chiefs. And so perhaps unsurprisingly, conflict began to arise between Ahebe and the male ruling elite of the area. Elders who considered themselves the ruling units of local life hated being spoken down to and having their powers usurped. They were the ones who should have been adjudicating cases and making decisions, but British power had put it all in the hands of Ahebe. Native courts took over from traditional decision-making processes by replacing traditional trials, which would have been conducted by the oldest men and women in a given area. Instead, British-sponsored native courts assembled, under the leadership of these warrant chiefs, a group of local elders who would adjudicate cases. And these courts could impose fines and sentences, and they were supposed to enforce local customs and native law, but oftentimes they didn't. He presided over a lot of cases. Adultery, theft, murder, refusal to follow orders. Most of what she did involved family law, and she seemingly faithfully followed the new British laws. Forced labor to serve the new colonial administration was mandatory, and she helped enforce that forced labor and actually used some of it to build a road between Nugu Ezike and her mother's village. And so to go back to the fact that these raids were first performed in order to, quote-unquote, abolish slavery, right? We have an invasion that is justified by ending slavery, which ends up pushing a subjugated population into forced labor. British Empire. Not even once.
British Empire 101.
The final phase of Ahebe's ascent was being named Eze, or king. Female kingship was rare in Igala society, and kingship in general seemed not to much have existed in her own society. As Achebe writes, quote, Ahebe broke new ground by introducing and imposing an autocratic form of individualized and masculinized authority in the office of king. Moreover, Ahebe's title was bestowed on her not because of her relationship with a man, but in her own right as a woman who had effectively transformed herself into a man, end quote. Contemporary intelligence report by the British described her as, quote, a chieftainess who had to become a man, and as such she has been regarded ever since, end quote. I want to pause here again to think about the way that the contemporary queer, trans, and audience would approach this story and to reinvigorate that dance of perspectives in thinking about the story. When we hear about women becoming men, we think about trans masculinity, right? When we hear about female masculinity, we probably think about lesbian butches, but vast differences in sex gender systems make this story not so easy to fit onto our narratives and assumptions. And I want to invite our listeners to think about this story and how it resonates with the many different ways that sex and gender can be linked and unlinked. If her story shows us that these things have been linked differently through time, then that difference should also warn us not to interpret her gender trouble through the same lens we'd interpret it in if it was taking place in cultural contexts we're more familiar with and in cultural contexts whose legacies inform the sex gender systems that we live in. Every time Ahebe went to court, she was carried by four large men in a hammock to the sound of Okanga music, which is a music of celebration and praise performed for honored men. So Achebe translates some of the lyrics of Ahebe's song, and here they are. The king has been propped up. The king is on her way to court. The king is through with the court proceedings and is on her way home. You will be prosecuted if you don't carry the king. You will be persecuted if you don't carry the king. A woman behaves like a man. Ahebe Ugbabe Bat Udoro. Ahebe, the king that confers with the lion. Ugbabe Ahebe, Ugbabe Ahebe.
So, well, maybe we can get into this later, but it's the gender is attached to the role, but the understanding of the people, like the song that they're singing, you know, refers to her as a woman.
Refers to her as a woman, behaves like a man, but so the king is on her way to court, but the king is also gendered masculine.
Okay.
So her palace was very large, and she actively managed her reputation in the community as this very sort of all-powerful and spiritually connected leader. She invited well-known medicine men from throughout the region. Her appearances were always accompanied by flute and drum music. She never let anyone see her feet touch the ground. She was always being carried from place to place. And so the palace complex included a market, stables, residences, guest quarters, and even a brothel, all of which were sort of within a series of earthen walls. And she even ended up having her own palace court, where she was able to administer native court justice, but without the British watching.
Huh.
And she lived in space inside the palace that would have been gendered as male. There's an extensive analysis of that by Achebe, but suffice it to say, it's convincing.
But is her power enforced by Igbo people or by the British?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, it's imposed by the British, and her status as warrant chief is given by the British. But one of the things that starts happening under indirect rule is that whatever society is being governed like this begins to change and reform around the new pressures, incentives, economic systems. And so the answer to that question is yes, right?
Yeah.
So she planted a lot of yams, and that was a sign of wealth. And her preferred courtiers lived in houses with metal roofs, which is also a sign of wealth. And she seems to have had sexual relationships exclusively with very powerful men, some of them other kings, some of them British officials. Mm-hmm. And she had 70 police officers to enforce her rules. And one of the things that she did was to take in women who ran away from abusive husbands. And she also married some of them, becoming their female husband. And again, some people might take a look at this and scream lesbians or Boston marriages, but Achebe argues convincingly that it has more to do with acquiring the social status of an elite man and father and husband to multiple wives. And these wives, like in the goddess marriages, they were encouraged to have sex with various men, but those children were considered the offspring of Achebe, and Achebe was actually considered to be their father. Achebe writes, quote, "Female husbands and their wives never shared a bed or other intimate sexual space. Ahebe's wives found sexual fulfillment in the arms and beds of their male lovers," end quote. But lest we start thinking of this as some kind of feminist utopia, he would also, quote unquote, retrain unruly wives for husbands who would pay her for this service with gifts. So husbands would bring their unruly or unsubordinate wives, and she would subject them to forced labor and beatings intense enough that they would eventually ask to return to their husbands.
Jesus.
But she also ran a palace school where a lot of local people received a primary education. And this was a co-educational mission school where children were educated in one of the first Christian missionary education books written in the Igbo language. Gender systems in Enugu Ezige had to do with these divided realms of male and female life, but also with human and spiritual life. There was a creator god who had no gender, and then different sort of lesser gods and goddesses who administered different areas of life. And there was an all-male masquerade cult which mediated between these worlds and which brought the dead back as masked spirits. And participation in this mediation process was limited to people who were both social and biological men, and participation in it was necessary to be a kind of full man or a free man, or the kind of highest level of man. And it was her intent on participating in this cult that engendered Ahebe's downfall. So she created and brought out a masked spirit that was enormous, flashy, and legendarily beautiful, and this went too far in terms of acquiring local authority. These masquerade cults were intended to signify and enact the limitations of human power. And here Ahebe was using one in order to enact taking too much power. Only initiated men were supposed to control these spirits. Women, including women who had become social men and uninitiated men, were supposed to run away and refuse to engage with the mask. And there were some exceptions that were made for elder women, postmenopausal women, who could engage with masks on some terms, but not by controlling one or by claiming one, which is what Ahebe did when she started staging performances of her masquerade dance with masculine music and lyrics, which described her as, quote, "a pit, an Odo masquerade that catches men, a pit that swallows men, a pit that swallows men totally," end quote. And in 1939, a council of local male elders decided that this had gone too far, and so they denounced her and removed the spirit from view. She took them to court, and this was such a big case that it had to be decided by a British judge sitting in Onitsha. The British man ruled that because she was a woman, she did not have the right to create a mask, instructed the elders to pay her for the materials that she'd used to create it, but to keep the mask in her possession. The British no longer needed her to accumulate or exert power in Enugu Ezike. The system of warrant chiefs was already fading, they were being replaced by British judges, and with her rule no longer useful to them, the British abandoned her. Her influence began to wane, her court lost its power, and the market moved out of her palace. Songs began to mock her rather than praising her. She died in 1948, still powerful, but never having fully overcome the loss of her position 9 years earlier. Today, Achebe writes, the people of Enugu Ezike, quote, have found in King Ahebe's paraphernalia a modern-day way to perform social and economic status and wealth. Ahebe's kingship relics are still being loaned out at exorbitant amounts to use for adornment during festive occasions, end quote.
Oh, wow. That's cool. You're listening to Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history, and we'd just like to take a moment to thank all our supporters over on Patreon.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible without you, and that's why we now have for Patreon supporters and Apple Podcast subscribers a new monthly podcast called Extra Bad Gays, and that's where we have more informal but still informed conversations about hot topics, current issues, current events, current culture, but we do it with that same analysis that makes the show. So this last month, we just talked about this new gay Fire Island nightmare community that they want to build in the Mediterranean. But it ended up becoming a much deeper conversation about the history of gentrification, about gay men's complicity in it, about how it affects queer communities. And that's the kind of analysis you can expect from the show, along with, episodes about Diva Down George Santos and our favorite and least favorite gay Christmas movies.
And if you still feel like you haven't had your fill of Bad Gays, why not check out our book, which is available now, Bad Gays, A Homosexual History, in hardback or paperback. And it's also now available in Italian translation and coming soon in Thai and in Spanish.
And that's at badgayspod.com/book. And our Patreon is patreon.com/badgayspod, or click subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Back to the show.
Well, thanks for that story, Ben. It's fascinating. So she dies about, when does Nigeria achieve independence? Like 1960. So it's like 12 years. She dies 12 years before independence. Mm-hmm. Does the sort of sex gender system that existed before, and also the sort of political system that didn't sort of really allow for kings until she ruled, did that return to as it was before her rule after she was deposed? Or... Had social and economic forces that allowed her to take that position. Did that sort of mean that that kingship system continued?
The forces kept changing. I'm not sure if she was replaced by another king in precisely the same way, or if any individuals accumulated quite that much local power under British colonization. But certainly the political systems that have developed in Nigeria since then have reflected a kind of hybridity between legacies of cultural and social traditions and ways of life from before colonization, and then also the legacies of, 50 years of invasion, followed by 60 years of indirect rule, followed by now almost 60 years of independence, right, since 60 or so. And it's not really possible to talk about, things going back to the way they were anymore, that we would assume that, a town in Britain was governed now the way that it was in 1880.
Right.
However, there might still be a family that owned a big house in the town in Britain in 1880 that is still a wealthy and prominent family in the town.
Yeah.
Right. Elements of the class system might have changed. Elements might have stayed the same. I think the political history of Nigeria since independence, which is a very turbulent one, involves several military coups, and there's been a kind of democracy with a few peaceful transitions of power between people and parties now since the late 90s. That system, I think, has a lot to do with the legacies of British colonization and with the enormously disfiguring effect on a place that comes from being subjugated, exploited in this way, and that comes from having different local governance institutions and ways of setting up life and kind of administering society and political power be so violently imposed upon, and then also in some way used, right, to interpret and enact British rule. I don't want to suggest that direct governance would have been less violent than indirect governance, but there is, I think, something particularly strange about the way in which indirect governance kind of perverts different kinds of local governance formations, right? Like, it doesn't, it's not that there's some local governance formation or some local way of organizing society that then becomes maybe a model for an alternative or, you know, something that can be kept alive as a form of resistance. Instead, you've got these forms of local governance being kind of adapted and adopted and reformatted to serve colonial governance.
Yeah.
Which really, I think, does a number on their meaning and on their ability to function in a kind of after scenario.
Yeah, it's a way that an imperial power or a colonial power can sort of pretend that it's sort of engaging in sort some sort of humanitarian style sort of mission, but in reality it's like straight up divide and rule.
Right, and you've also got, you know, Nigeria as it exists now is an assembly of many different ethnic groups which have different local governance systems, different regional governance systems, and different engagements with one another, which also changed over time, right? It's not, we don't want to paint a picture of pre-colonization, the kind of, you know, magical people all living in perfect harmony, right? That's not the case. There was human history going on. There were human societies. There were people and places and things, just the way that there are everywhere else, right? And social forces, just the way that there are everywhere else. But, you know, the what has been created afterwards is has often been a somewhat difficult accumulation of forces, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that has actually helped keep democracy going in Nigeria since the late 90s has been an informal but extremely serious agreement among all the different political forces that leadership will move from the northern interior of the country to the southern coastal part of the country so that the president switches back and forth.
Okay.
So, and this has been true since the first president of Nigeria in the current republic was President Obasanjo starting in the late 90s. He was from the south. His successor, Umar Yar'Adua, was from the north, then Goodluck Jonathan from the south, then Muhammadu Buhari from the north, and now Bola Tinubu from the south. So it goes back and forth between north and south, and at this point, Muslim and Christian, being the two Abrahamic religions that kind of syncretized with and to some extent replaced local religious traditions. Mm-hmm. And that's helped, like, that's helped keep some of these regional tensions between different groups down. There was also in the part of Nigeria that Ahebe was from, between 1967 and 1970, the Biafran War, or the Nigerian Civil War, which is where Biafra, which was a part of the sort of the part of Nigeria that contained mostly Igbo people, declared independence from a federal government that was dominated by Muslim Hausa people from the north. And I mean, there was a coup and a counter coup, and there were anti-Igbo pogroms and all these different things that were going on. But Biafra had oil. And so the Nigerian government did not find this acceptable, and they ended up blockading Biafra and pursuing deliberate mass starvation of Biafran civilians. So during the 2.5 years, 100,000 people died in fighting, but between 500,000 and 2 million civilians in Biafra died of starvation. And this war was actually one of the first wars to be televised for a Western audience. And a lot of the kind of institutions of paternalistic, you know, aid to Africa, when we think about like Live Aid and all of that, like all that kind of stuff, that kind of approach to, you know, help the people stop the war, etc. All of that began during the Biafra War, but of course, very little of it acknowledged the fact that it was precisely British colonization and indirect rule that had led to a lot of these ethnic tensions, and that had led to these different groups of people being kind of forced into specific national borders.
Yeah.
The bloody track record of British colonization extends until well after independence. And then after independence, when there's the Biafra War, then suddenly Western people begin to approach this as, oh, look at the poor starving children. We're going to help the poor starving children. Well, you caused the poor starving children, and you're rich because of the poor starving children.
And you're interested in the poor starving children now precisely because Biafra contains oil.
Yes, and also you're interested in them because there's suddenly a media image, and it's about your own kind of feelings of, satisfaction, moral satisfaction, right? You know, the kind of Bono politics of the 90s and 2000s and Product Red and, every time I clap my hands, a child in Africa dies. Bono saying at a concert and someone infamously screaming out from the audience, well, stop fucking clapping then.
Right. And in terms of the sex gender system, do you think it's difficult for people maybe who aren't from a culture of a different sex gender system to get it? Well, why is it more difficult for people to get these different sex gender systems than it is that when, for example, we talk about, well, you know, you can't really discuss a Roman emperor as being gay or homosexual, that's quite easy to grasp.
I think it's because of racism, right? I think it's easy for us to think about the Roman Empire, or easy for most white people to think about the Roman Empire as being a kind of place whose individual customs and whose culture and whose sort of way of being we need to respect, and we sort of think about with a kind of awe, right? Ironically, in doing that, we often misunderstand it, right? There's that great quote that, you know, we always want, the Victorians always wanted the Greeks and Romans to have somewhat better taste and better morals than they actually did. Mm-hmm. But when we think then about, or I think when a lot of people in majority white societies, European societies, think about colonial Nigeria or pre-colonial Nigeria, I think people are still thinking in the kind of racist terms of 19th century anthropology a lot of the time, right? People are still thinking in terms of the nature peoples, and, you know, people talk about tribes, right, rather than kingdoms or societies. People talk about, these people are often the subject of anthropology, right, rather than history.
Yeah.
Right? The presumption being that somehow a living community today is going to have a huge amount to do with a living community then, right? But you would never go to rural Brittany now and go on an uncomplicated search for what life was like 500 years ago. You might be able to find some traces of it.
Yeah.
But you certainly wouldn't be doing it in a kind of uncomplicated way. And I think that's why. I think people have a really hard time respecting and thinking about non-Western and particularly Black forms of political organization and social organization as forms of political organization and social organization, as opposed to as forms of the state of nature.
Uh-huh.
And it is when these things are appreciated as the state of nature that white Western queers then start looking at this stuff and saying, well, look, they had female kings. They had, woman-to-woman marriages. Here's the kind of, here's something that looks to me like what I am. So, golly gee, I've now found in the state of nature evidence for my own naturalness. Once you realize that this is a group of people living in a contingent culture, like any other group of people living in any other contingent culture, shaped by social forces, then you can actually start to take much more seriously what the meanings of all these different stories actually are. And I think their meaning is only true in the collective, right? It's not the case that I think we shouldn't try to learn anything from the diversity of sex gender systems in the world. I think that is an important lesson, that sex gender systems are diverse.
Yeah.
But I think we should try to lean into the ways that points to the radical contingency of our own, rather than trying to prove that any particular thing that we're in is natural. Because also, our own deviances from the sex gender system, right? Our homosexualities, our transnesses, our non-binarinesses, right? All of those things are actually also produced by our own sex gender system and are not simple alternatives to it.
Right. Great. Thanks very much, Ben. So, if people want to read deeper into the story, what was the source you used?
Well, yeah, the source is The Female King of Colonial Nigeria by Nwando Achebe, and that's from Indiana University Press. One of the nice things about this book is that, unlike a lot of academic books, it's actually affordable. The paperback is like normal paperback price, and the ebook is a normal ebook price, and it's available wherever fine books are sold. So do take a look at it, because it's a very interesting story. It's a deeper story than I could give justice to. And a lot of the things that I kind of summarized, saying, you know, well, you know, this is how it was, trust me, she makes a convincing case for it. Actually reading the way that she makes that case is extremely, extremely interesting.
Great. Thanks very much.
Well, I'm Ben Miller, and I am available all over the internet at Ben Writes Things and at benwritesthings.com.
And my name's Hugh Lemmy. You can find my newsletter at hugh.substack.com.
Until next week, see you then. Bye.
Bye. Bad.